Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step four, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
I remember being like, why is that kid so unhappy? And my mom was trying to explain, it's like, well, just imagine if like daddy or I started making a big mountain out of mashed potatoes at the table. Wouldn't you find that a little troubling? It's like, I guess, I don't know.
Since the dawn of 2009, one TV show has dared to ask the most important questions about the origins of our world. That show is Ancient Aliens.
Yet until now, no one has asked the biggest question of all. Is Ancient Aliens total bullshit?
And that's what our show's about. Finding the truth under the nonsense of one of television's most popular franchises.
This is...
more like Ancient Aliens.
You can hear the cocked eyebrow in that delivery, which I really appreciate. He leans into the camera and tells you something that you were afraid to admit to yourself, but upon hearing it, now you know. It's
that is an annoying part of being friends with me, is I will tell you something in that way.
But Alex, you're right. This is more like Ancient Aliens, a podcast that once upon a time was just about the hit pseudoscience History Channel show Ancient Aliens, and still is, although not for this episode, because since our pivot, we have now expanded it to being a show about how aliens and UFOs have infiltrated our culture through movie films, through TV shows, through grainy 1970s documentaries. We're covering it all. I am Brandon R. Reynolds, a journalist and someone who, as a child in the 90s, was a bit of a filmmaker and yet never caught an alien on film that I know of.
And I'm Toby Ball, the creator and host of the UFO podcast, Strange Arrivals.
That's right. And today we are covering the 2011 J.J. Abrams film Super 8. And our guest who asked for this film by name is Alex Steed. Hi, Alex.
Hello.
Alex does a lot of things. I'm going to go through some of them. Alex, you co-created and co-host a very good podcast called You Are Good, which formerly was called Why Are Dads, which is a feelings podcast about movies.
That's true. You've done your research.
Uh-huh. The OC again. Are you still doing that one?
Yeah, I am with Nico Stratus, which is ostensibly about the television show The OC, but is really about popular culture and music in the early 2000s.
Love it. Yeah, you're good at that.
I was even too old for it when it happened originally, so it's fun to do it now.
Yeah. See, so Toby, there is hope for you to go back to things.
Some hope, yeah.
From the
90s. My experience with Toby so far is I was too old for that reference, so I can't wait to talk about other things.
Yeah. Alex, you're also a manager for artists. Mm-hmm. You do live events. You are a hot shit photographer and zine maker. We've worked together on various things. We've been friends for a while. We met on the Joko cruise a number of years ago.
We did. What a blessing. Really, you introduced me to 10 new friends.
Yeah. It's been great. It's a real network. You know, I think of Alex as, because of all the things you do, I think of you as an alt mogul. Like, you're not building an app that's going to extract your data or a drone machine that's going to carpet bomb children or something. But it's you're doing a lot of cool stuff in all of these various corners that I'm always like, he's doing another cool thing. Alt mogul.
I really appreciate it. That's such a cool description. Someone also once said that they described my personality as an intersection between Mr. Rogers and Henry Rollins.
Oh, really? That's good.
So I was like, alt mogul, Mr. Rogers and Henry Rollins, we're doing it. This is great.
Nice.
That is perfect.
I do want to mention one other thing. I do have a podcast coming out called Los Angeles Demystified, which is esoteric histories of Los Angeles. So that's coming out probably later this month.
Yeah, Los Angeles Demystified. All right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Los Angeles Demystified. It's a offshoot of a show I used to make called Nashville Demystified. And this one is obviously about Los Angeles.
Yeah, all the stuff is good. Yeah,
awesome.
You're well equipped for talking about Super 8 here because of You Are Good. There is a lot of dad stuff in this.
Oh, you think?
Yes. It turns out that the aliens are not what we should be afraid of. It's our relationship with our feelings.
Exactly. So, yeah, so that's what we're talking about today. Super 8. Why did we want to do this one early? Toby and I had talked about, you know, a number of different ways into the aliens in mainstream. And obviously, one of the most mainstream alien connoisseurs in American cinema is Steven Spielberg. And J.J. Abrams has always been sort of a baby Spielberg. And
I saw it.
Find this thing.
No one believes me about this.
I believe you. What the hell?
This movie is Abrams at his Spielbergiest. You know, some of the reviews were like, this is good, but it's a little, you know, it's sort of like, remember that guy that was standing too close to you at that party for too long? It's sort of that feeling where you're like, okay, we know you like him, but. So, yeah, that's why we're covering it, because Super 8 ponders what would happen if the UFO from Close Encounters of the Third Kind crashed. And the answer is the alien would get pretty pissed off.
Yeah, it also is like, what would happen? It's like that. And what would happen if it had E.T.'s dilemma, but the government actually got its hands on it, you know, right. which is a fun element. Yeah, I don't remember how this was reviewed, and I'm sure it got shit for basically just being pastiche, like, because that's all it is. And then fucking pop culture made 5 seasons of this that took 10 years by way of Stranger Things. So, like, I find this is like a very quaint revisitation of like, get the Spielberg out of your system in one movie and move on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which that's what I really enjoy about this.
Yeah. And I like Stranger Things fine. I mean, it sort of didn't stick the landing, in my opinion. But yeah, that was that series, like, threw all of the tropes in from all the 80s stuff. We, in our bonus episode, which y'all should go check out, among other things, we talk about the fact that, like, Freddy Krueger was painted as a more cuddly figure in culture at a certain point. That bonus episode, which again you should go listen to, Alex posits the question of why there were aliens toys from the 1986 film Aliens, why those were released 10 years later, why they thought that was a good toy line. That was precipitated a conversation about all the crazy stuff that came out in the 90s, like a RoboCop cartoon. There's a real psychological analysis of why Toby had a Friar Tuck toy as a child.
Yes.
And just how different things were then.
it's a more innocent time, for sure.
We talk about all that stuff on the bonus episode. Go check that out. It's at grabbagcollab.com. Go there. Become a member of the More Like Ancient Falians family. It's only $3.99 a month. You get that.
Such a better job of promoting your bonus episodes than I do.
We're starting. We decided we better do so. And so we're doing. And it turned out that we really get some very interesting conversations out of it. The one before this was with Gabby Lombardo. She's talking about Oops, I Did It Again, the Britney Spears video, and all of its deep connections to young female development. So yeah, go check that out. Also, of course, go rate, review, subscribe. Please send us notes about what you think about Toby having a Friar Tuck action figure and how that might have shaped his spiritual development. If
there's
else.
A lot of room for discussion there, for sure.
Super 8 is a movie from 2011, J.J. Abrams. He wrote it, he directed it, he co-produced it with none other than Steven Spielberg. It stars some, you don't call them no names, but they weren't necessarily name brands at that time. Joel Courtney is the main kid, Elle Fanning in it. She's great. So yeah, Kyle Chandler being a bad dad. And one interesting thing about this movie, so it's set in 1979 in a small Ohio town, actually filmed in West Virginia because they needed something that looked like kind of post-Rust Belt America in decline. What are the kids going to do? A place that you could run a train through and no one would care, which interestingly, now we have these stories of these trains like exploding with toxic chemicals in small Ohio towns in the real world. And it's like, oh yeah, that is right. Kind of why they do it. Like they run all the toxic stuff through these places that are not as well populated. So the train, I guess, is the villain. Anyway, some kids are filmmakers. They want to make a movie about zombies, which becomes a through line and is a very funny little mid-credit sequence at the end. You actually get to see the movie called The Case played out.
He bit my friend.
Then what happened?
He was dead. And then?
He got up and walked away.
How did you know?
Anything left behind?
Yes, this fell out of the pocket, of the attacker's pocket.
Thank you.
And so JJ, I think this is such a funny limitation of technology. JJ wanted to shoot all the footage for that movie within a movie on actual Super 8 film stock. But then Industrial Light and Magic, the most powerful engine for special effects in the universe, was like, yeah, we can't do that. We don't know how to integrate CGI into grainy Super 8 footage. It's impossible. So he's like, all really? Right, can't use Super 8. I guess we'll do it on Super 16. Like, there's something that's too analog for Industrial Light and Magic to deal with. So very quickly, I'll run through the plot. 1979, Ohio town. You have a group of kids, Joe, Charles, and some others. The kid with the braces, who is a pyromaniac.
A perfect character.
Perfect.
From everyone's youth.
Yeah.
And then the handsome tall kid is a coward who throws up all the time at everything.
Brandon, did you relate to that kid? I was like, Brandon's in this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I was like, that was me. I didn't cry so much, but I was always sort of worried and sort of dumb. And
the handsome tall kid who suffers a compound fracture.
That's right.
I'm okay. Martin, you okay? Though I think I'm having a heart attack.
It's incredible. It's incredible, the bait and switch for the characterization, you know. I mean, the cute kid, Joe, is the main character. He's like, he's not too tall, not too short. He's the Goldilocks. And then Charles, interestingly, is sort of a, because like it's filmmakers on filmmaking, right? So like you think Charles, who's the filmmaker, you would think he would be kind of the hero a little bit. But in fact, he's more of a Orson Welles type figure. Like he's kind of selfish and monstrous and... Or Kubrickian, you know, he's like, I have to do my masterpiece and fuck all you guys, you know.
It's the only way he knows how to and I relate to this in a scary way, like I'm after years of therapy, less so, but like he only knows how to relate to people via projects.
Right. Yeah.
Like same. No one knows he has the crush on Elle Fanning because he can't even say it, because the only way he's able to gain the proximity is asking her to be in his movie. Like,
exactly.
That is my life.
I mean, mine too. We've all, me and Toby would not be sitting here if it wasn't like, we got to find something to do. I didn't know how to tell Toby I had a crush on him. So I was like,
But now it's out there.
Let's make a project. Yeah.
Let's make a project.
Let's make a project. Absolutely. This kid, I did not expect to relate to this kid as hard as I did on this viewing, but I was like, oh no. Oh no, me and Charles.
Yeah. Toby, were you a filmmaker as a child in the 70s?
It wasn't so easy to just make films as a child in the 70s, quite honestly.
Were you in New England in the 70s?
No, I was in the 70s, I was in West Germany, and then I was in New Jersey, and then I was outside Syracuse, New York.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You didn't have a movie making infrastructure when you were traveling.
No, not so much. I mean, it was really like the drawing the stick figures on the paper and then like flipping them through and having them run or something. Yeah, I remember. I'm trying to remember exactly when we first got a camcorder. And that was probably when I was in middle school, which is a long way of saying no. I didn't make little movies back then. I wish I had.
You were like, I'm waiting for this podcasting thing to become
exactly. I was like, if only that we could do this, but just talking.
I'm waiting until radio makes a comeback.
Exactly.
Alex, were you a movie-making young man?
I was, yeah. My single-parent household, Social Security, food stamps, and free lunch, and I got a cash job when I was 12 years old, and I bought a video camera for myself when I was like 13, yeah. And then started just making and shooting stuff. Radical case of ADHD that was undiagnosed and never monitored, so my ability to finish a project was 0%, but like I was always making, I was always in the process of making a thing that would never get completed. But I was always, and then I started making zines when I was 15, so yeah, I've been making stuff as a means of expression and relation since I could work illegally.
Yeah, same. I mean, one of the things that they don't get into, this is like a lot of Spielberg stuff, I guess, or Spielberg related stuff in this case, the idea of class and how that works is, you know, hinted at but never really deeply explored. In this case, you're supposed to understand they're middle class, whatever that meant in the late 70s at the time. But what made that stuff hard to make those movies was like you had to have that film developed, that cost money. And then Alex, for us, you know, we were in the digital era where like once you got that camcorder, you have videotape, you know, you can shoot it on these little mini cassettes. And that was cheap, you know, you transfer it to a VHS or whatever and you can reuse the tape, but it's all in-house. You don't have to take it to some developer to deal with. And yeah, so, you know, you kind of have this boom of creative projects. That's how, you know, I got to a point where in high school, anytime we had a project to do for English class or history class or whatever, I was like, I'm just doing a movie. They're like, you can do a paper, you could do a poster board presentation. I was like, I'm doing a movie. And so that was the thing that I ended up doing. So I really appreciated that. Also, a lot of stuff that didn't get finished unless there was a assignment deadline.
Yeah, and what we're dealing with in this movie, right, is I think the camera belongs to Joe's dad. It belongs to Coach Taylor. You know, like, and
in the second half, because it
in
breaks.
The second half, right. So like you would need to, what's the kid's name who I relate to? He has to like go and pay for the, he has to go and pay for the film developing. But like that was like what is happening around this time. And Toby mentioned a part of this earlier, and you just mentioned it with regard to the digital stuff, is like at least one family in a friend group is getting a camcorder or is getting something to shoot with. And that's like the beginning of this. And then obviously as the technology becomes, you know, storage becomes easier for less or development becomes non-existent, like it's starting to proliferate, which is like why we then start seeing that's, which is like why the 90s is like all skate videos, is like you didn't have to develop anything anymore. You didn't need to like, you didn't need to have a filmmaker on crew. Like you could actually make your own stuff. I absolutely related to Joe because I was a buy practical effects out of the back of a Fangoria kid. And he refers to Dick Smith's guide to movie makeup, which I had. And I very much thought that my actual career, which is just very funny about how little I could see about what the future was going to be like, was going to be practical special makeup, practical special effects, specifically in like makeup. Mm. So, you know, seeing this kid have all of the same frames of reference and all of the same, you know, aspirations and all of the same heroes was, I think, really stood out to me when I first watched this movie.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
So, okay, these guys are making this zombie movie and they want to do a scene. And the director, Charles, is like, you know what? He's learning how to be a writer. He's like, we need conflict. We need interpersonal conflict. Why do we care about these people? The main character is this detective. He's the one who throws up all the time. And he needs a wife. So, Alex, as you said, they ask Elle Fanning's character, Alice, will you come be the wife on this? And so they shoot this scene at the train station where he's going to go. He's sending her off to Michigan to escape this zombie apocalypse or whatever. And then an actual train comes through. They're shooting through that. Then a pickup truck drives onto the tracks, drives right into the train. The train derails to a degree of violence and
it's unbelievable.
That belies belief. Like, I mean, there are cars flying hundreds of feet in the air, landing, exploding. I mean, it's incredible. You would think that the pickup truck had an atomic bomb in it. I mean, it was
that
just...
That derailment just kept going.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to die!
Yeah, like, how did those children survive any of that? They were right next to it. It was incredible. But luckily, the camera keeps going, and in the wake of this disaster, an alien escapes from one of the train cars into the woods. You don't see it. You never see much of it other than glimpses, but the camera picks it up, and everyone survives. There's also all of these weird little Rubik's Cube-looking cubes, and the main character, Joe, takes one of them, and that will be important later. But then, yeah, the alien is captured in this footage from the camera that keeps rolling. So that's how they're like, wait, there's something going on. And from that point, conspiracy ensues. The military rolls in. Noah Emmerich, who just the top line of that guy's career must be a dude who knows way more than he's letting on, who is involved in some kind of conspiracy. He was a spy in the Americans. He's the best friend in the Truman Show, and then in this, he plays a military guy who knows that they've been carting an alien around forever and is trying to shut the town down.
I mean, even in 2011, like some of these tropes about like the military moving in and it's top secret and nobody can know, and like finding a reason to evacuate people out of the area. There's an evacuation scene in Close Encounters, right? Supposedly there's like poison gas or something.
And there's a quarantine in E.T.
And there's a quarantine in E.T. And it wasn't just about this movie, but it feels like I'm watching the same movie again and again and again, just from like different sort of angles. And like you sort of insert different characters in it. But like so many of the beats are kind of the same. And of course, Strange Arrivals embodies this, right? At least the first season, which I think was the good season. And then I kind of went off the rails, I thought. But
your podcast, Strange Arrivals?
Not Stranger Things. God, Stranger Things. I always get this fucking...
It's like Toby is shitting all over his own podcast.
There are only so many words.
Yeah.
You know?
It was a terrible, terrible choice to name it that, because I always get them mixed up. Yeah. Sorry. Stranger Things.
None of thyself, Toby. Strange Arrivals really fell off.
Strange Arrivals. The first one was awesome. The last two were just bullshit. You know, my frustration, I guess, with the movie a little bit was that it did feel... Again, like pastiche, it was like it was taking all these things. It's like, okay, I know the speed. It's like when the fathers, like when you first see the fathers are kind of being dicks, you're like, okay, well, this is going to resolve at the end. You know, there's going to be some reason why they come and to the aid of their kids. And they realize that they actually love them, that all this other stuff is sort of peripheral.
Like alcoholism.
Yeah, that's right. Alcoholism.
That guy needs to slow down.
We need
to, hopefully he talks to somebody.
Yeah.
Elle Fanning hugging her dad.
He makes bad choices.
He makes a series of bad decisions in this movie, for sure.
Yeah.
There is some kind of comfort in, I think, knowing how these things are going to resolve themselves. You know, like It would have been interesting if, in fact, like the fathers hadn't embraced the kids, or like at the end, they're like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, I told you not to do this. Like, you're grounded or something. But there were times when I was like, I feel like I've seen this before. And I think it's because it's like it's drawing on these things that particularly Spielberg had done in the past. At least that was my thought.
It's like pastiche fan fiction about all these movies. And all of the big, all of the boomer auteurs were guys who wanted to make movies that were fantasies about resolving stuff with their dads.
Yeah.
And ask the question, what if the military is bad, actually?
Yeah.
And like, look at Minneapolis. They were right.
Yeah.
Like, look at Trump and his dad. They were right. Like, these are like two of the foundational questions about like how we exist, and not sort of, you know, not necessarily like individual members, but like we use the powers of this society typically in ways that are you know, we're not looking out for the aliens' well-being,
right?
And it turns out that like because a certain generation of people found it totally impossible to like express feelings to their children, we have a lot of fucking little psychopaths running around and making life impossible for the rest of us.
Yeah. On that note, Gabriel Basso, who plays Martin Reed,
who's a tall, vomiting
kid,
kid
who throws up a lot, played J.D. Vance in Hillbilly Elegy on Netflix.
Oh, really? Well, that's good range from a guy who vomits all the time to J.D. Vance.
Absolutely. He can do it all.
Yes.
He can do it all. J.D. Vance never vomits,
no,
as far as we know.
When you do see the military show up after this train derailment, you're not like, oh, they're here to help. You know, everything's going to be fine because the military's shown up and they'll make sure everybody's safe and everything goes. It's like, run away. Don't tell anything. Don't give them your film. The assumption is that they are nefarious.
Yeah. And I think that like, that's like what, you know, that's what the US is struggling with in the 70s is,
yeah,
being like being split between the narrative of the greatest generation and then of Vietnam, and having to be like, what? It's so funny that you have the kids doing this like aside you mentioned earlier about their Vietnam experience.
Yeah,
it like almost feels like a like coming home aside.
Yeah.
Like they're doing this like sensitive thing about everyone knows like one or their uncle who won't talk about it, you know what I mean, or their dad or whatever who just won't talk about it. But yeah, this is like what's happening in the text of Spielberg movies, and then it's happening in this like, again, tribute to a Spielberg movie where people were really struggling with reconciling their view of the military from 20 years ago and their view of the military now. And not just that, I don't want to say the military, I mean like American engagement,
right?
I should say specifically. So yeah, but like to like put it out in 2011 and having it be an entirely different context, like I think that you have to just be like, I'm here for Spielberg fanfic in order for it to land.
Right. No, yeah, I agree. This is put out at the time of like, thank you for your service when you're walking through airports, right? I mean, it's a different attitude.
But interestingly, from the alien perspective, right, this is 2011.
Which is the important perspective.
Important part. We have to think about, where are aliens in the discourse? So we're in the middle of two wars, right? And Spielberg, at least, had gone from aliens as these gentle things in Close Encounters in E.T. in the late 70s, early 80s. 2004, he did War of the Worlds, where he's like, aliens are bad. And that was his whole take on 9/11. It's a little bit on the nose, I guess.
I had the weirdest experience with that movie, which is a slight digression, but I will tell it anyway, is we went to see the movie in New Hampshire at the local mall. And when we left, we were driving in to like grab a coffee or a drink or something in Portsmouth. And as we drove, all these cars were pulled over on the side of the road and people were looking up in the sky. And it was very weird, right? And then for about 10 minutes, it was like, why are all these cars pulled over? Why is everybody looking up there? What are we missing? Like, what can't we see? And then it just turned out it was some random fireworks.
All right, where were we? So the military rolls in. Joe's dad is a sheriff's deputy, and he is very cold and emotionally distant, in part because at the beginning of the movie, Joe's mom dies at the local steel mill, which interestingly, that's the first shot of the movie is, you know, it's how many days without an accident? It's like 734 days or whatever. And you see someone like somberly take those numbers down and change it to one. The mom dies. Dad doesn't know how to deal with it very well. Very distant, problematic. And then that's a nice pairing for the Alice character, Elle Fanning. Her dad's a drunk. Her mom ran off. So, you know, both of them have like weird dad issues. So government rolls in. There's this guy, Dr. Woodward. He's the one that drove the truck into the train. He's a local science teacher who, as it turns out, has been studying this alien phenomenon. And it turns out he was recruited to work on this project. The ship had crashed in, I think, the 60s. So it's not a direct one-to-one with Roswell, but it's that same idea. The ship is made of these sort of Lego blocks that look like Rubik's cubes, and it can change shape. So he worked on it. He was so guilt-ridden that he tried to stop it by driving his truck into it. Somehow, in all the chaos of the train crash, he did not get totally annihilated. So he lives for a while. You have Colonel Nellick, who is Noah Emmerich. He's the one who's like, we're going to shut this town down and recover this alien.
Colonel, I've got a lot of people in my town that are going to want to know what's taking place.
Which town is that?
Lillian.
Pick it up. Deputy, if you're asking me if we had any dangerous property on board this train, I can assure you the answer is no.
Colonel!
Excuse me.
So then that's sort of the middle of the movie is the town gets quarantined and they're going to evacuate it by starting a fire in the woods. Meanwhile, Joe and Alice are getting closer because of the aforementioned dad stuff. There's tanks everywhere. The aliens running around, occasionally snatching up people and then maybe eating one or two of them. It all revolves around this water tower, as it often does. There's a tunnel under it that the alien has dug because the alien is revealed to be an underground alien. And Joe goes looking for Alice, who's been snatched up by the alien. Finds her down there. It's a very It type of scene.
Also very King Kong.
Yes. Very King Kong. Yep. Oh, yeah, right, with the water tower. The fireworks kid sets off fireworks to distract the alien. They snatch Alice. She wakes up. There's some other lady with curlers who I'm not sure why she
was killed.
Yeah.
I guess she was just there to like, die.
Her body gets annihilated by being slammed into a cave wall.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, oh, well, what? Okay.
It's so very funny, the like random violence that happens to strangers in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're not supposed to know how to feel about it. You're like, oh, okay, am I supposed to identify with? Nope. She was just there to demonstrate that the alien still wants to kill people or to like make sure that we know it's still dangerous.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Adults have a rough go in this one, for sure.
The sheriff.
Yeah,
exactly. You guys need to hurry up. It just gets snatched. So funny.
It's like, where are we going?
After apparently being underground with that alien for a couple of days or something, and it just turns on
him.
He was
so close.
Yeah. He had it. He was, almost there.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place, so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month, so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
So the alien, it turns out, is psychic, and that's how they're able to communicate with this monstrous thing, which looks a little bit like a giant spider, a little bit like kind of a classic xenomorph, a little bit just like a big giant thing. Like, definitely not a gray alien or anything.
No.
Its face is kind of like a gray alien. It's got the big eyes. Once it finally chills out at the end, Joe confronts it, and he's like, you're not bad. You're just misunderstood, and you've been... Yeah. Institutionalized by years in prison, which, as we know, prisons create criminals. And so that's basically what happened. He got institutionalized. joined a gang, probably, who knows. The alien turns nice. We realize he was just wanting to go home. He climbs the top of the water tower and using his psychic powers or some kind of thing, magnetism. All of the Rubik's Cubes get drawn together, as well as like all the metal crap in town, microwaves and bicycles and like other symbols that we saw throughout the movie. And that all gets turned into a spaceship in some kind of way, including the last thing is this locket that Joe's been carrying around, which was his mom's locket, which apparently was the only thing that they could recover because she got squished by some kind of machine.
That's right. Pylon. They were like, it's not going to be an open casket.
Which was a very funny bit right at the beginning. You're like, okay, let's get a little bit, a little dark.
Why didn't the alien just do this to begin with?
I mean, I think that's a fair question.
Like, if he had the capacity to do this, why didn't he just do it?
Well,
it was
trapped in like sort of, it was like in prison. They had it in prison for a long time. So I think it had the capability to eventually do this. But uh-huh. Like the reason why that the teacher broke it out is it was in communication with it psychically or whatever. And then it was getting transferred to a new facility. So he was trying to make this opportunity for the alien to get free and make its spaceship, and that it couldn't have when it was in prison.
But why couldn't it have just done it right after the train crash? Why was it cruising around and like killing people and, you know, like taking away all, what were the air conditioners or something? Who's it? The one woman was complaining.
Yeah. It was like sourcing all of the material it needed.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why there wasn't enough metal around and it couldn't make.
There's a train crash, Brandon. There's a huge number of broken trains.
That is true.
Yeah,
that is true.
I don't know.
There's only so many things I can justify. But, you know, also the, like, idea of the motivation.
I'm not trying to point out plot holes. I was just, I was wondering if there was, like, an explanation for it or whether it's just, you know, it's a short movie if he just does that.
It is hard with alien movies, now that I'm thinking about it. It is sort of hard if you have an alien that has more than one setting or motive, right? Like in Aliens, we understand that they're essentially a hive animal and all they want to do is like reproduce until, and we'll talk about this when we get into Prometheus, the idea that like, no, they were actually created as part of this larger evolutionary engineering plan by these engineers, whatever. E.T., he's nice front to back, like Close Encounters, like they're always peaceful. But in this case, it's like, well, he's probably nice, but then, you know, because he's locked up, he also will eat people and like kill ladies with curlers in their hair. Right. And so you, the viewer, are like, am I supposed to like this guy? Am I supposed to understand that aliens like people are just kind of complicated?
He's been in prison for 30 years. Yeah. Like, right. That's enough to be. And like, I feel like the whatever point there is in this movie is it's like, who's the real monster? Is it us? Uh-huh. Like, often. And because we're so locked out of, you know, we're so pro-subjugation and so anti-feeling your feelings. Like, we, you know, maybe Curler's lady wouldn't have gotten killed if we hadn't locked that thing up and tortured it for 30 years.
Right. And that goes all the way back to like the day the Earth stood still, right? It's
sure.
Like they come in peace, and then you know we're reflexively violent, and that's what happens.
That's why I think like Mars Attacks is hilarious because like in Mars Attacks, which is like very much like a, you know, an homage to Ed Wood style like B movies, is the aliens come and like people try to give them the benefit of the doubt and they are just here to annihilate people.
And that came out before this. So there was like War of the Worlds, then there was Mars Attacks, and then this. So the idea that like aliens can be assholes, that's in the zeitgeist at that point, I think.
Which I like.
But it does seem like this one, the aliens, do you guys think the aliens, is there some point about aliens in this, or is it just that in doing a homage to Spielberg, we know Spielberg loves aliens, so let's do that. But really it's more about kids learning how to be creative in a small community, and also, you know, the emotional driver being like people have issues with their dads and moms are nowhere to be found.
The aliens are one of two things in text. It's they are aliens and there's something to be said about aliens, or it's they are the other, and this is a they are the other movie. And this is a, like, how do you treat the other and what is the blowback from that? And it's not surprising that this is a how do you treat the other and what is the blowback that we get a movie
within 10 years of striking distance, pardon the pun, of September 11th also. Right. That like we're strongly considering that maybe our approach to people who have resources that we really want and maybe disagree with or under the impression we disagree with culturally, like perhaps that like some of what we are doing is having some negative repercussions back home. And I think that like that's very much what is in the zeitgeist of like a Spielberg movie and has to be in the zeitgeist of a Spielberg fan fiction pastiche movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's it.
It's like at the end, it's like, oh, here's one empathetic kid. And, you know, having seen that, I guess I'll take off.
To that point, Toby, about empathy, like I just recently watched E.T. and that movie should just be called Empathy the Movie. Like it's like about a kid who has empathy.
Yeah.
Like that's what the movie's about.
But I think that's a Spielberg thing too, though, isn't it? It's like children have empathy and adults have kind of lost it for the most part. Except for Richard Dreyfuss, maybe. I don't know. Does he have empathy? So I guess he's just confused. It's a little hard to tell.
Apparently lacking some of that in his actual life.
Sorry, but that's what makes him such a good actor, Brandon.
He loves mashed potatoes. Though.
Yeah.
He's a big mashed potatoes.
Yeah.
Brandon, what's your take on what aliens are in this movie?
JJ is fascinated by aliens, like he did Star Trek, but he also did in 2021, he did a four-part series for Showtime called UFO, which was inspired by the 2017 New York Times stories and government reveals. And we haven't seen it yet, so I can't speak to it too much. But some of the people he brings in, like Richard Doty, is this famous like intelligence agent who has lied about all kinds of stuff. So he has like all these voices in here that would seem that he is biased toward the idea that the government is covering up the reality of aliens, or at least that he's interested in exploring that. And Spielberg is the same way. Like Spielberg said in an interview with Colbert and James Cameron, speaking of aliens, that he's like, he believes that the government knows about UFOs and that aliens are real and all that. And so, you know, just how that informs the way they're making these projects, you know, and he's got Disclosure Day. Spielberg has Disclosure Day coming out in June, which is, you know, going to be another alien movie, possibly his last great big epic alien film.
Oh, I was so shocked to see the trailer for that in the theater. I was like, I didn't know we were still doing this.
Yeah.
Great.
I know. Right. So what's informing that?
Well, it's the new UFO, again, like 2017, I think kind of changed the conversation a little bit from whatever it was before then. There was like alien abductions were big. And then there was like this period where I don't think there was a whole lot going on in the UFO world except for the normal stuff. And now it's suddenly very sort of military and geopolitical rather than sort of a personal thing now. It's like you have a lot less like, oh, it was out in a field and some lights came down. Instead, it's like the USS Nimitz like picked this stuff up on radar and we scrambled jets and they couldn't figure out what it was. And if that's the way like Spielberg conceives of it, you know, that's completely different than the actual movies he's kind of made about it. I guess maybe Close Encounters is a little bit like that, but it feels like there's some kind of fundamental sort of unknowability about this current age of UFOs, where it's just like these things, we don't understand them. We don't know why they do what they do or how they do what they do. And that's like a long way from E.T., which is just like, you know, aliens have the same sort of emotional and needs that humans do. It seems like it's almost the opposite of that. It's like we don't have any reference point for them, partly because I guess we haven't really seen an alien. In this sort of understanding of it, we're basically picking up signals of craft or whatever bullshit.
Yeah, and I think Spielberg was a lot more invested in the belief in like America as sitting on a hill and that the government was a good thing and, you know, all of these American projects.
No, come on, no. Steven Spielberg's an extreme cynic about America. Extreme, like these are all of these, again, all the 70s auteurs are guys who believed that in their youth and then were disappointed by Vietnam.
Hmm.
I don't believe that at all. I think that they're all, him in particular. I mean, like E.T.'s not about they have the same emotion. That's the setup for the government's going
right.
to, then the government will come and dissect your friend.
Right.
Right.
I don't think he has optimism about the U.S. at all, and all of his movies seem like a nostalgia for the time when he did believe that, but he seems extremely cynical.
Richard Spies and Lincoln are both very, like, you know, capable men doing things to preserve the Republic. But it's also true that those are not modern set ones.
I think Spielberg is a believer in the American everyman.
Yeah.
And I don't, and I think that he is extremely cynical about the hostility of the people in charge.
Although Close Encounters is interesting. And again, I haven't seen it in a long time, but my memory of it is that this idea that the government is sort of trying to keep Richard Dreyfuss from getting up Devil's Tower and sort of their sort of nefariousness or whatever is in fact trying to clear the place so that they have no interference of this interaction that they're going to have, a peaceful interaction they're going to have with the UFO when it finally comes, and they do like, and they send people off to this place. But it's, again, it's been a while, so I may be missing out on some of the nuances.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Any final thoughts on Super 8, Alex?
The only other thing I want to speak to is, like, I remember being so taken by, in an appropriate way, considering the age disparity and how old she was, like, by Elle Fanning's acting in this movie. I remember when seeing her appear, like, I was just like, who the fuck is that? Because there are these really amazing scenes between her and Joe where she is like, you have all these kids and they're little shit for brain kids. And then she's this girl who's obviously sort of dealing with a lot of her own stuff at home. And she is like an actor. Like she is great and sort of like carries herself well. And she does these scenes where like she tries to figure out like how to act the scene, and they're really incredible. And I think that, yeah, I can think of very few more impactful sort of like introductions to a large audience than this. She's like she's masterful in this movie.
Yeah, I definitely thought that. And also Joel Courtney, who did not have the same career that she did. And I think kind of does like maybe sort of Jesus-y movies now. But I was, you know, I was so impressed with him. I mean, he, same kind of thing. Like he just is, he's very present. He's very present in the scene. He like really knows how to engage with the camera and with her. And the two of them together, I think, are very realistic. And particularly at the tears, like when you see, like you said, Alex, he has to act and he's a bad actor in a funny way in the movie, within the movie. She's learning how to be a good actor within that. Like she, you understand that she's able to access her emotions more directly, and that just comes out. She's channeling that stuff, which is always a cool, like, I can go on and on about art within art, but I'll leave that for another time. But it is such an interesting tool to like reveal kind of the inner workings of a person by, you know, how they're writing something or how they're acting in a movie within a movie or painting or whatever it is. Toby, you like the barfing kid the best, or
the barfing kid,
fireworks
yeah.
kid the best?
I'm all about the barfing kid. The barfing / broken leg, your bonus showing kid.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a nice little moment. I also,
funny movie.
Yeah. I was actually pleasantly surprised by the movie. Like I was somewhat dreading having to watch it, but then it turned out to be, you know, it was enjoyable. The whole thing just feels so familiar when you watch it. And part of it is probably in retrospect based on stuff that's happened since that movie came out. But there is, you know, it feels like sort of an encapsulation of a type of movie in sort of this very pure form. And that has a lot of the same sort of thematic elements that
I
think are sort of what More Like Ancient Aliens is looking at, is sort of assumptions that are made in popular culture about our government and the alien presence and the way normal people kind of experience it or interact with it. So, yeah. And you, Brandon?
I think anytime we can question the government's motives about anything, it's always a good experience. You know, what's going on in those train cars may not be something that you want to see, but maybe it's something that has to come out. And, you know, so the train car is the Epstein files, is basically what I'm saying. And the little tiny cubes.
There's mentions of Noam Chomsky.
Continue the metaphor, please.
Yeah.
The little tiny cubes are pictures of Noam Chomsky and Steve Bannon embracing.
There it is. Yeah, they're the surprising historical figures that you wouldn't think would be on the island who turn out to be on the island saying disturbing things. And then eventually they'll all merge together.
I didn't even know that Noam Chomsky was capable of hugging, let alone hugging Steve Bannon.
Yeah, Noam Chomsky came out of nowhere.
And that's what it feels like, is in the same way that at the end of the movie, all of these various esoteric elements of the city, the small town, the bicycle, the microwave, the bits and bobs, they're all coalescing into this weird core. That's what's happening with the Epstein files. It's like all of these random elements, people, whatever, are being pulled magnetically by the force of their own sins toward this central point that we're all now able to regard them as it becomes this mothership. And hopefully is sent into the heart of the sun, never to return. But I guess that depends on what we Americans have to decide what to do with it. But we've got a lot of other shit going on, too, so who knows. Alex, where can people find you?
You Are Good at Feelings podcast about movies, wherever you listen to podcasts. The OC, again, wherever you listen to podcasts. And Los Angeles Demystified, which has a trailer up, which means you can go and subscribe so you'll hear the first episode when it comes out.
Awesome.
Excellent. Instagram?
My name, Alex Steed. That's a good one. And then there's other things to follow in my profile if you want to follow more.
And as I said, he's an alt mogul, so you'll see many different many different threads being tugged on there. Thank you, Alex. It was great having you on. And listener, I highly recommend you go check out the bonus, grabbagcollab.com. We talk about a lot more crazy stuff, toys and so on, and it's well worth a listen. This has been More Like Ancient Aliens. I am Brandon R. Reynolds.
I am Toby Ball.
And we'll see you next time.
Next time on More Like Ancient Aliens. Fox Mulder and Dana Scully. Iconic duo, intriguing will-they-won't-they situation, and the protagonists of The X-Files, the most popular UFO show on the planet in the 1990s. We dive into The X-Files by looking at the iconic episode, Jose Chung's From Outer Space, Season 3, Episode 20. Come for the knowing satire of UFO lore, stay for Charles Nelson Reilly. See you next week.
Go to grabbagcollab.com, subscribe, check it out. Please remember to rate, review, and do all the things. More Like Ancient Aliens is a Grab Bag Collab production. Our producer is Heather Eagle Ears Wilson, and our music is by Nathan Reedy.